Session number 6840.
Reel 7.
I went along to York to Stencil Barracks for my D-Mob, and I was with a chap called Ernie Francis from Middlesbrough. And when we got the train at Middlesbrough Station, he said to me, "These D-Mob suits is no good to me. I want a decent suit." So we walked up Linthorpe Road, and as I was going to get the bus at Middlesbrough Town Hall to go home, opposite the town hall was Hector Powell's, the high-class tailor's. And when I looked in the window and I seen suits were £25 and £30, I nearly fainted. I was used to the idea of 30-shilling suits. 3 guineas was very, very good, and for 4 guineas you could have a 4-piece suit which included a pair of plus fours. It just shows how inflation had caught up at home. With us being out of touch for so many years, I didn't realise the way prices had rocketed. When the Korean War started, I got my call-up papers again, which I could hardly believe. And my wife, she said, "If you go this time, I'm going to go with you as a camp follower." But I said, "No way am I going." And I got in touch with the family solicitors, Thompson, Trotter and Gray, and took them my call-up papers, and they read them and said, "Well, there's nothing can be done. This is quite in order." So I stormed out fuming and went further down Albert Road into Queen Square and called at solicitors called Jackson, Monk and Rowe, showed them my call-up papers and also Ministry of Food documentation, which proved that we had over 2,200 ration customers. My business was just starting to flourish again after the war years, and if I'd have to go back into the force once again, well, the chances are my business would have folded up. And as I explained to Jackson Monk and Rose Clark, I was only called up in theory as first militia for 6 months military training in July 1939. I wasn't a territorial, I wasn't a regular soldier, I wasn't a reservist, I didn't join up for the duration of the war, I wasn't even conscripted on the Defence of the Realm Act when the war came on, and yet for some reason best known to the War Office, I was being called up again. I said to Jackson, Monk and Rowe, "Do they think I'm Errol Flynn in disguise, that I won the war single-handed?" Fortunately for me, they took the case, and the next thing I knew was I had notification from IC Records stating that I would not be required for military service in Korea. I mean, one of the reasons I formulated my appeal on was the majority of camp guards we had throughout our captivity were Koreans. And it is a long arm of coincidence, but it could be that if we had gone to Korea and been taken captive, it is a possibility that some Korean may have recognised us as ex-Japanese prisoners and thought we in turn were spies and been summarily executed, which to me was a travesty of justice. Any VPOW should be called up again for Korean service. But I know without fear of contradiction, at least one person, a chap called John Blair from Middlesbrough, was called up for Korea, which to me was absolutely ridiculous when you think about many regular soldiers and that we must have had that we could have sent to Korea instead of poor blighters like us who should have been through the hoop, should have to face a second dosage. The epilogue of my story is this. I went to a prisoner of war reunion at Scarborough in March 1983, and on the Friday afternoon I heard 3 chaps talking, and I thought to myself, these chaps come from either Suffolk or Cambridgeshire, somewhere in that area, and I went across and inquired, and they said they were from the Cambridgeshire Regiment. So in turn I inquired if they knew of a Corporal Barwick who had been staying back in Saigon to give evidence at the War Criminals Tribunal. And they asked what company was in. I said, I don't even know if he was in the 1st or the 2nd Battalion of Cambridge's, let alone the company. All I know was a voice on a tannoy in Saigon, Indochina, all those years ago. So they said to me, look out for a chap with one arm. He has a great knowledge of all the chaps in the Cambridgeshire Regiment. On the Sunday morning, we're having breakfast, and my wife said to me, there's the one-armed man. And I turned on to him and said, what do I want a one-armed man for? Clean forgetting the incident of meeting up with these chaps on the Friday afternoon. Anyway, after breakfast, I found this chap and had a word with him, and he said, to the best of his knowledge, this Corporal Barrow had passed away some years ago, so I suppose it's just the end of a mystery which I'll never solve as to what happened to Corporal Barrow all those years ago. I'm sorry, but these are some parts I've missed. There's not much, but I'll relate them so you can collate them later. While on Singapore Dock, the first time round while we were working at Capel Harbour, Go Down 19 was noted because it contained lots and lots of players' tobacco leaf. So invariably, the lads used to go along and steal some of it. One of the Sikh guards that had formerly been in the British Army turned up with the Japanese, and in turn, they patrolled the Go Downs. And one of the chaps he caught, I can't remember his name, his nickname I know, was Hassan Effendi, because he was an old Egyptian soldier. He grabbed him and was blowing his whistle, which of course alerted some of the lads. So what happened was, one of the enterprising lads grabbed hold of a fire extinguisher and sprayed the Sikh policeman. And then the Japs instantly collected us together to have a roll call to check if there's any of the men missing. Well, we knew the number the working party should be. So after numbering off about the first three or four numbers, the last chap, we just barked like dogs. They killed the last chap, and he knew the correct number he should shout out in Japanese. Say, just for talking sake, he might be in Sanjuichi, San Kitts. And the Japanese, not being able to count very well, they just accepted the last man had called the correct number. And in spite of the fact there was a couple of lads was missing, because they had to wash off this spray that they got from the fire extinguisher, the Japanese was none the wiser. I recall another hilarious happening. We were working on a boat which was loaded with sake. And of course some of the lads had to taste the sake to see what it was like. And it was pretty tasteless from what I understand. But the heat, the combination of the heat in the hold, which was really tremendous, and being on meagre rations, the sake soon knocked them out. And we were finding, instead of a shift changing over after about every 20 minutes because of the intense heat, that nobody was coming up out of the holds. When we descended to relieve them, we found they were all laid out, absolutely drunk as noodles. So we had to have rope slings dropped down and put the drunks into the nets and have them pulled up and dropped at the dock side. Of course, we indicated to the Japs that they were Taksan Bioki. It must have been so hot down in the hold. I never found out whether the Japs believed us or otherwise, because they were just laid out there till they sobered up. A further instance appertained to the dock life on Singapore. I recall we were unloading a boat laden with sugar. So, of course, we made a point with our metal cleats of tearing some of the sugar bags and helping ourselves. So the Japanese sent down a Chinaman to stitch up any bags that was torn so that the spillage of sugar would be reduced. I suppose that we were evil-minded, but we purposely laid one of the bags so that when the sling was going up, they were often caught on the side of the boat, and this bag tipped off and fell and killed the old Chinaman. I suppose, in a way, he was just trying to be a natural survivor by collaborating with the Japanese. And we, in turn, never anticipated a fatal accident. We just thought it'd be a warning to him to leave some of the sacks torn so we could help ourselves. But it was just one of those things that misfired. Will you please note, between Kanyu and Tasso, I've missed this part out. It's appertained to a place called Wampo. At this point, we were doing what was termed as hammer and tap, using a cold chisel and a 2-pound hammer, but to slowly tap holes into rock. which was filled in turn with gelinite for blasting. And a chap called Jackie Pyle, who was a shot firer in the pit, was helping the Japanese soldier or engineer called Tanajima. Now then, Jackie naturally was having long fuses working back to short fuses, and of course clearing off in the jungle to before the thing exploded. But Tanajima had the idea that was spoiling the Jap war effort, that all fuses had to be the same length. So Jackie informed him if that was going to be the case, he was going off in the jungle along with us. Well, Tanajima done as he thought fit, and naturally he blew himself up. Some time later, along the line, we seen some engineers coming along with lines and lines of coloured workers. And one of the engineers turned round when he came to our working party and shouted, "Ah, Jackie Pyle, number one soldier, Tanajima Cemento." I mean, he was stupid, which showed he had eventually found out the folly of his ways. Between Plancassi and the final link-up, I'm sorry, but I missed a further part out. It happened that during the monsoon, as we'd been working through, we'd built the embankment, and once the monsoon had got in full spurt, you would find there was rivulets that had never existed before. And what had happened was, part of the embankment had been washed away. So the Japs decided that the culvert would have to be erected, but it allowed the water to go through. So the chap in charge of our squad, a lad called Smokey Joe, indicated to the Japs that this rivulet would have to be diverted, and in turn we were going to take up the railway line prior to blasting out the rock base to make a culvert. But as soon as we started to remove the fish plates, the Japs went berserk and then clonked him over the head. The only conclusion we could think of was that they must have thought the fact we were taking up the railway, we were sabotaging the Jap war effort. So we left the railway lines intact as told, bothered underneath them, and then of course we finally tapped out holes into the rock, and they stemmed the rock, and of course in turn blew up the railway line, the stupid beings. I sometimes wonder what kind of engineers they were. At Da Nang, I recall, we had a Japanese soldier, or he may have been a Formosan. They called him Takahana, and he's one of these dreamy kind of fellas. He'd have the job organised, then he'd just go and sit in the shade and doze off to sleep. And this particular time, we were loading ammunition onto a small lighter onto one of the jetties which we'd made, and he'd dozed off to sleep. And one of the Kimpatai came along, and of course after a lot of curras and different yelling and screaming, he found Takahana, where he dozed off asleep. Well, he went into the poor beam, making an awful mess of his face, and of course Takahana in turn dared not retaliate, and the Kimpatai chap, he got into his bicycle, disappeared, and poor Jap soldiers came at the double and took Takahana away. We never seen him again. I just have no knowledge of what happened, but I suppose it must have been a serious offence to fall asleep when you're in charge of a squad of prisoners of war, which was loading ammunition.